Hello, I'm Regina Botras, and this is Backstage, where we talk with the who's who on stage, in dance, comedy, and performing arts, speaking with the leading theatre makers of our times and how they came to the stage and what drives them and inspires them. And I am so excited to talk to my guest. Sarah Giles joins me, the director of No Pay, No Way, which is back after a short run in 2020. I can hardly believe it's been that long. It feels like yesterday that I saw that original staging. Sarah Giles is an award-winning opera and theatre director, described by Limelight Magazine as one of Australia's most thoughtful theatre makers, has a passion for comedy, I can see that, and opera, and has directed over 25 productions for companies, including Sydney Theatre Company, Melbourne Theatre Company, State Theatre of South Australia, Malthouse, Griffin, Australian Chamber Orchestra, and so many more. And you may have seen The Importance of Being Earnest for Sydney Theatre Company, a marvellous production that showed humour and class at its fullest. I just adored the staging and especially the opening scene, which really juxtaposed the two worlds and the genius comedy and choreography. It makes me think of the language and space of theatre that she uses, and the same goes for No Pay, No Way, with the set design playing a huge part and the comedy and characters within the world building. But we will get to that. She's also directed Accidental Death of an Anarchist, The Popular Mechanicals, Perplex, Mrs. Warren's Profession, and so, so many more. Let's welcome Sarah Giles to Stages.
Hello, thank you.
Thanks for coming on. Look, before we get into you as a director, did you grow up in a creative household? Like, where was this sort of desire to be involved in the theatre? Do you remember the beginning?
I do remember the beginning. My brother, he started doing ballet. That's not true. I think I started before him. When I was about two, I started going to this ballet class, but it wasn't your sort of traditional strict ballet class. It was run by a woman called Penelope Nunn in South Yarra in Melbourne. She would just invent these shows at the end of the year. They would just come from her brain, and she'd use Roy Orbison music. And she was this kind of, and she's still working. She's this powerhouse. And there were a whole bunch of people who came out of that who've gone on to have kind of creative careers. And so that was my first experience of live performance, really, was doing her concerts. I mean, both my parents are creative. I mean, my mum, she's an endocrinologist now, which is a, she's retired now, but she was a medical specialist, worked in diabetes. But during her studies, she'd always been such an amazing fine artist. And during her med studies, she took a year off and auditioned for the VCA and got in for sculpture and went to the VCA for a year. And my dad has always, he's got a real creative flair. His job when we were growing up really was he would buy old crumbling houses and kind of restore them and fill them with antiques. And then we'd live in them and then we'd move on to the next one. So there was always kind of creativity around. And my brother is also, he's an incredible fashion photographer and just standalone photographer, actually. And so there's always been lots of creativity in the family, I guess.
Do you remember the first thing you saw? Like, I mean, you were in it before I think you saw it, it sounds like.
Yeah, I don't remember going to a lot of plays as a kid. I know my mum and dad must have taken me to something, but my family were not really into the performing arts so much. Mm. It was more like fine arts or kind of. My best friend Tess, her mum Sally Brown, who was a fashion photographer, a fashion designer back in the day, she would take us to plays every now and then. And I think my mum must have taken me to the ballet at some point. Mm. I think the first play I really remember seeing was when my high school took me to see a production of The Chairs by Eugene Ionesco, which Julie Forsythe and Paul Blackwell starred in, Mark Downey played the Oracle at the end. And that was the first time I remember seeing a play and kind of going, oh, this is my world. Ah. This feels right.
Right. Wow. So how quick was it for you? Like, how did you make that decision? Or did you go like, I've seen that, this is what I want to do, and from there pursued?
Yeah, I think it was sort of, it might have started there. And then, I always loved, my high school had a really great drama program. Mm. And my drama teacher, Brenda Joyce, who I'm still in touch with, she was quite amazing, quite a force to be reckoned with. And she was quite inspiring and had a lot of integrity. And so we would often make our own shows and write our own shows. And there was a program that you could do in year 8 and 9 where you could act in a co-production between sort of two different schools. Mm. And I auditioned and I got into that. And that was one of my first kind of roles I got into. And then the following year, they chose some students who'd been performing in it the prior year to then direct it. And so then that was my first experience directing. Ah. I think I would have been about 15. Wow. And we directed a production of Franz Kafka's The Trial, the Berkoff adaptation. So not a light play, but there were three student directors. And funnily enough, one of the other student directors was Simon Stone.
Wow.
Who's now gallivanting all over Europe making Olivier Award winning operas. So that was my first experience directing. And so from about that age onwards, I would sort of do acting and directing simultaneously or take it in turns. And then when I got into uni, Susie D, one of Australia's kind of finest theatre makers, was running Union House Theatre. And then I sort of did a production with her. And then my first assistant directing job was with her at University of Melbourne, where she was directing Studs Terkel's Working the Musical. And that was kind of the beginning of me properly pursuing directing. And then I started auditioning for drama schools and got into NIDA and moved to Sydney. And that was sort of the beginning of my kind of, career, really.
Yeah. So do you think, I mean, from the works that I've seen that you've directed, there was a very kind of physical element in it. Do you think that dance influenced you? And do you agree? Like, do you see works in that, like, quite physical space?
It's funny. I think what dance did for me was an understanding of kind of bodies in space and timing. And all through high school I did music and I studied Italian. So there's a, inside me is like an inherent kind of rhythm and logic and sort of mathematical sense. But I think in terms of the physicality, the thing that influenced me more was probably, yes, dance, but also cartoons and comics. And I know that sounds odd, but my obsession with cartoons and comics started very young and I never grew out of it. And I'm still quite obsessed by animation and comics and graphic novels. And I think it's something to do with the framing and how my best mate and I growing up would just devour Archie comics. And the way that a comic reveals the story is kind of through framing, which is very – well, not dissimilar at all to theatre and how I think about theatre and my time. And I, at about this point, I'd sort of started watching Ren and Stimpy and then The Simpsons. And so actually when I think about stuff and when I see it in my mind, it often kind of feels very cartoony and very exaggerated. And so I think perhaps the way I communicate with actors and how I think about how things unfold physically is often a slightly kind of perhaps exaggerated or quite precise way, because when I see it in my head, it feels very cartoony. One of my favorite films in the world is The Triplets of Belleville, a French, there's no speaking in it, it's a French animation feature length by Sylvain Chomet, and it's just exquisite. I mean, the imagination and kind of joy of that world is something that, I admire greatly.
That makes so much sense because, you know, as I've sort of read around the things that, you know, comedy was one of the things that has influenced you, but also the comics or the cartoons with that style of comedy. Is there, I mean, I guess that's why you're drawn to it. How's that relationship between you and comedy kind of grown over time?
Oh, it's amazing. It's kind of amazing. I remember when I left drama school, my grad show was a comedy. I did The Bald Soprano by Eugene Ionesco, I was so thrilled with how it went and everyone was like laughing hysterically. And I remember leaving drama school and going, I really want to keep directing and I want to make comedies. But I remember being vaguely ashamed of my interest in comedy because I sort of felt like, well, no one's going to take me seriously. No one's going to think I'm intelligent. And that at the time there was this kind of spate of young male directors all doing kind of tragedies and plays about grief. And I was sort of mostly interested in comedy. And it was a thing that took me probably most of my 20s to kind of come to terms with. And once I just sort of said, and I have to say having kids was a huge, hugely great for me because I just stopped caring. I didn't have time. And so I threw myself into the world of comedy in a way that I'd sort of been slightly nervous about. And I think the thing about comedy is that there's such a there's such a skill set in terms of directing comedy and making comedy, and I was saying this earlier today actually, that you know, when you direct drama, if you fail or if you succeed, the audience is silent both times. But when you're making comedies, if you fail or succeed, there's a very audible difference between what that sounds like. So the stakes of doing it are kind of enormous. And so my relationship to comedy, I've always been drawn to it. I've always loved it. But it wasn't until my kind of late 20s that I started seeing how comedy could be political and how it was a great way, in the words of another great kind of comic brand, Declan Greene, he used to talk about like Trojan horsing politics into a play. And I think that's what comedy does so well, is that you can entertain and have an audience having a really terrific time, but also then thinking about things that they might otherwise not be too interested in thinking about, whether it's to do with gender or whether it's identity or inequality or power. It's, I think, the perfect form to have difficult conversations with your audience.
Absolutely. It kind of sneaks in sideways and gets you in a way. It hides its plan. Are there many choices? Like, are many people writing? Are there many plays that are comic?
Oh, I mean, yes, there's so many. There's whole genres that we're not seeing much of. Yeah. I mean, there's the entire kind of absurdist genre is incredibly funny, but I think it requires a very deft eye and a very specific set of skills to kind of nail that. I think what can happen with comedy sometimes is that people end up when you're making a comedy, it can start off very well. And, you know, initially it's incredibly funny. And then you get into the kind of what I call that middle slump of rehearsals where you're kind of just either having to repeat things that already worked. And obviously actors are these incredible creatures who can invent. And so it's all about maintaining that level of truth and not putting, as they say on SNL, a hat on a hat or a joke on a joke. And so the amount of restraint and kind of technique required to keep repeating something or to keep drilling something is really difficult. And so often what can happen with comedy is I feel like it can kind of steer off course. And I feel like that happens a lot with the absurd genre. There's a lot of old farces that are superb that we don't see a lot of. And I think it's because, well, a lot of the European farces, often the translations that we've been reading are English, and they have a very particular tone to them. And then a lot of the English farces from back in the day often feel a little politically stunted, I would say, for want of a better word. A very famous comedic play would be, say, Noises Off.
Oh, yes.
But the gender politics inside that make it sort of not terribly appealing to me. So the thing I'm always looking for are kind of political comedies. So, you know, when I studied Italian in high school, and then I did it as my undergrad at Melbourne Uni. And so someone like Dario Fo, who is so, I mean, he's such a genius, and him and Franco Rame, the work they did together is genius. And they found these great ways of entertaining audiences, but inside them is a real kind of political nub. And I mean, even something like The Importance of Being Earnest, I think, has a great politic inside it that often is just ignored because people think, I think people think comedy is just fluff. But actually, I think there's such a political side to it. Even a film like Bridesmaids, I think people would go, oh, it's funny, but when you think about what that film did politically in its moment, it's kind of extraordinary. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of politics in comedy that is often either misunderstood or ignored.
Well, that brings us to No Pay, No Way. And this is terribly comic, but also with that sort of subtext of currency, I suppose, set in the 70s. Do you want to kind of set the scene for audiences?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the play's a farce. Yeah. So what that basically means is, the plot is really the inciting incident of the play is a housewife who's recently been made redundant. She goes to do her shopping with her weekly money, and she goes to the supermarket, and inflation means that the prices are now triple what they were yesterday. And all the housewives are there. It's 1970s Italy, so it's a very particular political time. Society is very religious. Gender roles are very specific.
Mm.
The police are very corrupt and the government has no interest in the general good of people and, rather the general welfare of people.
Mm.
And so all these housewives are a bit fed up. And so instead of paying the price, they just loot and they steal all the food and they race it all home. And what ensues, and so the play starts from the moment Antonia, played by Mandy McElhenney, from the moment Antonia walks into her home, she has to hide that food. She has to hide the food from her husband, who will divorce her and kick her out and report her to the police if she finds out she's stolen food. And then eventually she has to hide it from the police who come knocking, looking for all the loot. And what happens is her dear friend, Margarita, hides some of the food under her coat and momentarily appears to be pregnant. And it's about that beginning of that lie and the kind of exhaustion of, I mean, and what the genius of Faux is that, you know, he's saying so much about what we expect of a certain element of society and the exhaustion of poverty. And I mean, a slight side note, I read this incredible book when we were researching this called Poverty Safari, which talks about class and talks about the exhaustion of poverty and what that actually does to a person. And, you know, what Faux does is he keeps us entertained while we watch these couples have to kind of run around like maniacs just trying to survive and hide and lie. And it's, you know, like a good kind of Seinfeld episode. There's sort of five different streams all happening simultaneously, and it's when those streams collide that things are just sort of breathtakingly, incontinently funny. Like there's so sort of the genius of all of those strands meeting is just divine.
It certainly is. It is such a – it is entertaining. That's the thing about comedy. But having a look at this play 4 years later, wow, how is that
return being? I know. Well, I mean, you know, on one level, just so on one level, hugely depressing that the play is still relevant. If so, more relevant.
Yeah.
I think Faux would probably want this play to drift into – you know, distant memory and no longer be relevant. Mm. So on that sense, it's kind of depressing. And on a kind of personal sense, we're sort of, it was so heartbreaking for so many artists in the performing arts when COVID hit that we didn't get that closing night. Mm. And as a director, I mean, it's even more torture because every time you watch the show during the season, you're there and all you see is the stuff that's not working, that needs to be improved, that could be tinkered with. And so when you watch the show on closing night, it's really the only time you sit down and just enjoy it.
Right.
And so to be kind of denied that, because I think we only got a couple of weeks into the season before it got shut down, it was just – and also I feel like this production for me, I've been kind of working solidly since I kind of – well, since uni really. And this particular production had been a show that had been in my mind for a good 10 years and I'd been talking about wanting to do and I'd found ways of doing it. And so to then not kind of get it to run its course felt hugely devastating. It was the show that I'd wake up every now and then at sort of 3 a.m. in my little house in Melbourne in the middle of that lockdown, feeling just so heartbroken that we never got to kind of finish it. So incredibly grateful to the company that they kept it in a shipping container for 4 years. And sort of glad that it can kind of continue to speak to, I think, a pretty urgent political problem that we're having.
Mm. And I love that story that in when it was first premiered in Milan, it saw those kind of actions happening.
Inspired. Yeah, inspired riots.
So good.
I know. They were, and Faux and Rame, you know, the way that they would make theatre, they'd travel around, they'd present it in the streets. There was a, you know, they really had a huge following and kind of were huge political figures. I mean, you know, there were so many laws in Italy at the time about protesting, about what was legal and what you were allowed to do. I mean, you know, when they did Accidental Death of an Anarchist, the production would regularly get shut down by the police. I mean, they were really speaking truth to power in a state which had no interest in that. And the corruption levels that, you know, we saw in 1970s Italy were so astronomical. I mean, it's sort of important to remember that after World War II, all the power figures who worked under Mussolini weren't flushed out like they were in Germany. A lot of those people ended up moving into the police force. And so there was a particular level of corruption in the cops that was it's kind of unfathomable for an Australian, even though we do obviously have corruption in every element of society. In Italy in the 1970s, it was something else. And, yeah, and I think what Foe is so critical of is just how this system is not working. And and really the sort of big lesson of the play is these, you know, working class characters who are abiding by, you know, the husband, the character that Glenn Hazeldine plays, Giovanni, you know, he's an adamant unionist. He believes that if you go through the right channels, things will change, things will get better. And really the sort of great message of the play is that the system's broken, and it really – it asks people to play by the rules even when it means they're not going to win in the end. And we're seeing that just across every element of society. We're now moving into, I think, what, our 15th month house price increase. Yeah. We've never had such a steep interest rates. It's home ownership just is now not a given. It's just that that's not possible anymore. We're turning into a country where people will rent for life. Investment properties, negative gearing, there's a real... the haves and the have-nots, we're just getting wider. And it's, and I think we're sort of told that, well, it's your fault. You know, if you work hard and if you save, you too will get to where Generation X got or whatever. And it's just not the case. And I think there needs to be some really major reform. And that's, and the, you know, the genius of Foe and Rame is that all these messages are got across with just the deftest of touches and the most entertaining of jokes to an audience who I think, you know, would sometimes maybe not be willing to engage with that conversation. But it's a really beautifully put political argument.
Absolutely. So what is, you mentioned earlier, there is a skill set with comedy that's like, what's important for you as a director to find that comedy within in a play, say for this production, like what, how do you come at comedy? I suppose,
I guess, I mean, the number one rule is truth. That you need to have kind of very clear given circumstances. So that's, you know, where are we, who are we, what do we want? There's sort of I think when comedy is not based in truth, that's when I think things start to feel not funny and feel a bit kind of skew if. So for me, it's kind of making sure that there's a kind of baseline and an understanding of stakes. What is at stake? What are we all those sort of you need to have your feet pretty firmly planted in that kind of world in order for things to be funny. And that's sort of the first thing I think about. I think rhythm is another thing for me. I think a lot about the rhythm of how things sound, and that when we're rehearsing, we're working towards, I think comedy and music have a lot in common. And so for me, the sound of a joke or the sound of a sequence of lines, it feels a lot like a kind of string quartet. There has to be a rhythm and timing, and you can hear when you're drilling things whether things are kind of landing or not.
Right.
And I guess like my job as a director is to kind of be the ideal audience of one. So whenever I'm rehearsing something, I'm always trying to remember that an audience is seeing it for the first time. So you can't put a joke on a joke. You can't put a hat on a hat. You have to try and tell the story, be very clear. And then I guess it's also about encouraging actors to find choices that sit within your kind of level of madness. So, you know, beautiful Aaron Sindos, for instance, you know, we were talking a lot about some of his bolder choices in this play, and they all came from a place of truth. So he always talks about going for the pullback note. So he'll keep going and going and going and coming up with bigger and bigger offers until we sort of go, all right, that's too far. And so that's another kind of process thing. I think comedy can be, yeah.
I was just going to say, are you directing actually the choreography or the physicality as well, or do you kind of hand that over to the actors?
No, I mean, you just have to, you direct everything. You encourage.
Yeah.
You know, I think like.
More or less or.
Yeah, or you talk about references or you say, my God, you found this great thing there. Like, keep doing that. Or what about this, you know, like, for instance, like there's an amazing moment where Emma Harvey is being dragged out of the room by Aaron Sindos. And we were talking about, Emma had some great ideas about what she wanted to do and, you know, how could I, what could we do here? And then like an image sprung into my head, which was trying to put a cat into a pram. And so we talked about the physicality of putting a cat in a pram. I mean, we didn't really talk about it. I just sort of shared that image. And then the next time Emma did it, she found this kind of particular way of moving her limbs, which was just genuinely hysterical. So it's also about finding ways of exciting an actor and finding a particular dialogue with that actor. So the way you talk to individuals is quite different. And also like the ensemble, like finding the different instruments for each character. So you sort of, someone in your mind might be a tuba, someone else might be a flute, someone's a bassoon. And so it's just finding different ways of communicating different things with different actors, and that genuine collaboration between a director and an actor, and when it soars and feels exciting and kind of genuinely collaborative and fun.
I just love that. That is perfect. I can see a tuba and it's so hilarious compared to a violin, which has a different kind of humor, a different kind of place in the orchestra.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the role of, you know, comic duos. So like, for instance, with this play, you often see people, you know, you see Antonia and Margarita together. So they have to be complementary, you know, the yin and the yang, the straight line, the curvy line, those sorts of things, those kind of rules of comedy. And then similarly, you have Antonia and Giovanni. And so you've got to think about those pairings. So they're all the things I think about a lot when I'm casting. So for instance, when we did Ernest, you know, all the different configurations of people you see next to each other, you're always thinking about. I'm also always thinking about physicalities and heights and, you know, people's bodies and how they kind of relate to each other and complement each other and can play off each other. And I think when you think about something like Seinfeld, like, you know, obviously George is a certain height and Kramer's a certain height. So the scenes between them have a certain physical relationship. And so I think a lot about that. And I think once again, that comes from cartoons and how exaggerated people can be and costuming, how that can kind of change those elements of people. Or someone's pants being too big versus pants being too tight versus there's so many different ways of shifting someone's physicality just ever so slightly that can just be to absolute hysterical effect.
Absolutely. And I love that the women are so strong and obviously comic in this play. I mean, not enough women. Yeah.
I know. And that's the thing, like back in my earlier days of feeling like no one would take me seriously or think me intelligent for being interested in comedy, I started digging around. It was about this time that I started reading a lot of Alison Bechdel's work and then came across her very famous, now famous gender test, the Bechdel test, which loosely is, and lots of people have heard of it now, but loosely is about a way of figuring out gender bias within certain texts, whether it be a play or a book or a film. And to pass this test, you have to say yes to three questions. In that play or film, is there a scene between two women? Do you know their names? And do they talk about something other than a man? And very few things pass this test. And I remember when I was kind of reading around and trying to find plays to pitch, this was when I was a resident with Kate Blanchett and Andrew Upton running STC, and I was always trying to find plays that passed the Bechdel test, and it was quite difficult. And after lots of reading, a dear friend of mine, Laura Maitland, suggested I read Mrs. Warren's Profession, the Bernard Shaw, and that passed, and I was sort of interested by that. And then I remembered this play because I'd studied it at uni and I reread it and was kind of blown away by these two brilliant characters. And I think what's so extraordinary is how Foe and Rame have got the politics of the time so deeply embedded into the bodies of these women. It's not so much what the women say in this play in terms of what they carry politically, but it's how their bodies have to operate, how they have to run around, the things they have to do and hide, and the form of the thing is what smuggles the politics in. And these female characters just felt so. Yeah, I'm always on the hunt for plays that have fantastic kind of female protagonists. A political comedy that passes the Bechdel test is my fave, I reckon.
So when you're watching in the rehearsal room and you are being the audience for the actors on stage, because this is a skill, to be looking at it freshly, and are you laughing out loud for them as well in that space, you know, that ability to be a blank slate?
Not always. I think, like, you can't laugh at the same thing for 6 weeks straight. It just stops being funny. But you just have to remember that it was funny in week three, and now you're just finessing how to repeat it perfectly. So at some point you do stop laughing, but as new things are found in other moments that become funny, you start laughing at them. And so what happens usually towards the end of a comedy rehearsal is everyone in the room gets a little bit kind of stressed and goes, is it funny? God, is it funny anymore? Is this funny? Is it funny? Are we funny? And I think the more you focus on whether or not you're funny, the less funny it gets. And so that's when we start having to really dig down on what I was talking about before, given circumstances, truth, stakes, timing, precision, all those kind of things, craft, really. And then when you do your first, what inside Sydney Theatre Company is called the company run. So that's when everyone who works inside STC, from admin down to the workshop to costume to ticketing, all those people come into the rehearsal room and they watch you do a run. And that's the first time the actors hear a group of people laughing. And there's a huge collective sigh of relief because you go, yes, it is funny. And it's really, and I think for the actors, it's a huge game of trust with the director because, you know, we'll be watching it and the question is it working? Is it funny? And I'll say, yes, it's very funny. But I'm sometimes not laughing by that point. But that being said, like, rehearsals is always a kind of, although it can get very serious and very bogged down in technique and technical elements, there is always laughter and humour. And even if we're not laughing while we're rehearsing a scene, I'll often finish 10 minutes early and we'll watch some stupid thing on YouTube, or someone will crack a joke. Or so there's always humour in and around the rehearsal process, even if it's not
directly.
But, yeah, I mean, I laugh a lot. But, I guess my point is I can't laugh at the same thing every single time, because the minute I start forcing laughter, I reckon I'd probably get a bit stressed.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, Sarah Giles, thank you so much. I've learned so much in this chat. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure. I hope, it's I love talking about all this stuff because I've got such a love of comedy and a love of these brilliant actors and our brilliant, I mean, I haven't even talked about our brilliant adapter, Marie Carty.
Oh, yes.
I mean, she's just a genius word wizard. Some of her lines just bring me to tears. And so she's such a delight as well.
Absolutely. And she'll be doing a creative workshop as part of STC. I'll make a point of giving those dates across. Sarah Giles, thank you so much again. It's been terrific.
Thanks for having me. Lovely to chat.
Well, the fabulous Sarah Giles there, the director of No Pain, No Way. Some insights into comedy and the Bechdel test. Look that up. Exciting. And as I mentioned, Marika Hardy will be giving a workshop, creative workshop as part of STC on the 13th of June. So keep an eye out for that. Book online now and get to the theatre. Such a great production. Just laugh out loud. I stood up with a standing ovation when I saw it. Just a brilliant look at, well, our times, really. Our supermarket's duopoly is really playing into this production. Bye for now.